the people who control the existing system willingly let in the Bitcoin because they see NGU or number go up technology. But what they don't see is that they're empowering the freedom go up technology that's inside. A signal of Bitcoin's failure would be nobody's using it, and there is no nation state adoption, and there is no corporate adoption, and it remains a niche technology with no value that a handful of people use. We're seeing this thing go from a few million dollars to $2 trillion. We're seeing it being adopted by Wall Street and governments. And at the same time, they aren't able to neuter its power. This is how we separate money from state, is we get everybody to adopt it. And if you get enough people to adopt it, they'll realize one day that they can no longer print the money in the same way that they can today. It's over for the fiat currencies. People are going to want Bitcoin.
What Bitcoin Did is brought to you by our lead sponsor and massive legend, Iron, the largest NASDAQ-listed Bitcoin miner using 100% renewable energy. Iron are not just powering the Bitcoin network, they also provide cutting-edge computing resources for AI, all backed by renewable energy. So whether you're interested in mining Bitcoin or harnessing AI compute power, Iron is setting the standard. Visit iron.com to learn more, which is iren.com.
Like, in whether quantum is real, whether it's going to happen, whether it can kind of break Bitcoin is way above my pay grade.
I think it will.
I assume at some point
it won't break Bitcoin.
Well, it'll mean those addresses can have their...
There will be vulnerable addresses.
Yeah.
What do you do with them?
Exactly. That's the interesting part.
Or do you even presume that you can do something with them?
So why do you say that? Because I presume you can.
Well, the two sides of the debate I've seen so far are... Don't do anything. Let the quantum attackers take the coins and distribute them back into the economy.
Yeah.
The other side says, no, we shouldn't allow people who develop a completely unrelated technology first to just enrich themselves in that way.
Yeah.
And, you know, we need to basically create a fork scenario where after a certain date, those coins are unspendable.
Yeah.
And the argument there is basically that, hey, those people have already decided that, well, they've either lost their keys. Or, you know, they're going to be victims in some way.
Yeah.
And the other side of it says you can't tell the difference, obviously, between someone who's just saving for a very long time and inactive and someone who has lost their keys. You can't tell. I think it's fascinating because I think there's good arguments on both sides. But I do think it's becoming really obvious and clear that at some point, some set of Bitcoin, maybe a couple hundred thousand or maybe even about a million Bitcoin will be vulnerable in this way.
Yeah.
You know, in as much as they won't move to safe addresses and they'll be vulnerable. And I guess the question is, who do you think the attackers would be at that point? Well, probably nation states and large criminal, you know, or large criminal enterprises, right?
Yeah.
So they're going to get all that. Now, I'm personally, I think I would tilt towards... sort of the don't touch, let them go, because I think they're just going to sell them back into the economy. And I think that's okay. What are they going to do? It's not like they're going to hodl them.
Yeah, exactly. So, it'll be bad for Bitcoin price, but...
They were discussing on this show, it was like on the Bitcoin Optech review. It was interesting. But it was basically, they were talking about Parker Lewis's position was kind of the one I just laid out, where it's kind of like, well, let the attackers go for it. Whereas I think a lot of developers are saying... No, we should make those coins unspendable. So I think that's going to be a big conversation, but it's sort of interesting. Like I don't feel super strongly one way or the other. Like I'm going to be curious to see how it plays out.
Yeah,
but it's definitely going to happen. That's clear.
That is clear. My kind of one way or visceral the other. Reaction to it is we have to not touch anyone else's coins. And so when I was speaking to Adele, I kind of made the analogy, which he said is a horrible analogy. But I think I kind of convinced him a little
bit.
We didn't really get down to like which side he fell on. We just kind of laid out both sides. But I think there is a pretty clear comparison between the DAO hack and what potentially would happen here.
Interesting.
Now, like for me, I don't think you can touch the coins. I think that has to be just accepted that they're stolen. But like the really interesting part, I think, is with all the new players that we now have in Bitcoin, like Sailor, BlackRock, they're almost certainly, I think, going
to
fall on
You're
the
side. Saying forking to make them unspendable is sort of like rolling back the chain.
I think there's an analogy there.
I think there's something loosely political about it that I don't like. I like the fact that Bitcoin's apolitical and that we can't really mess with it. And this seems to... just kind of cross over that line. you know, it's making a decision about a particular set of UTXOs, you know, without the owners getting to weigh in. Mm-hmm. And I'm not that comfortable with that.
No.
And I understand it's not great if, like, a couple large nation states and criminal enterprises or whoever's going to have access to the fastest, best quantum, basically, is going to take those couple hundred thousand or million coins, which in 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, whenever this happens, is going to be enough to buy, like, an entire country. Like, that's going to be an enormous amount of wealth, right? But, you know, I think there's something poetic about some of those lost coins coming back in. And I just, right now I'm on the side of just kind of let's see what happens and let people secure themselves if they're able to. And that kind of fits with the opt-in nature of Bitcoin. And I would hate to see someone like think about someone who's, I don't know, like for whatever reason in a coma or tapped out or frozen or, you know, whatever. And they have their coins though. But they can't move them. And what, we're just gonna delete those coins from the UTXO set? I don't like that. So I don't know, but it's a fascinating debate.
Yeah.
What's interesting is we're obviously a ways away from it, but at the same time, it's like gonna become a pretty clear debate, I think.
For sure. And I think like it seems to me that that's, I can't see a way that that's not a violation of property rights if you do that. Mm. Even if you think you're doing it with good intentions.
Yeah, because, like, think of it this way. You know, Saylor has said he wants to burn his coins when he dies or whatever. I don't know if he's joking or not, but that's what he said, right? Okay, and he's kind of, I think, going along the lines of what Satoshi said, which is that it's a gift to everybody else. So you're going to undo that? That's also a violation of property rights. Like, what if people have chosen to burn coins? A lot of people chose to burn coins for one reason or another. So you're going to, like, you're going to undo that decision for them. So that seems also...
That's interesting.
Yeah. So I don't love the, we're going to make this decision for everybody else and sort of the new Bitcoin is going to not recognize those coins. And I guess Parker makes an economic argument that it's better from an economic sense to allow the coins to circulate again.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't dug too deeply into that, but... It's just fascinating. So, you know, this is going to become a major topic moving forward, very quickly. Like by this summer, it's going to be, everybody's going to have an opinion on it.
That's yeah, I
like
think so.
It went from like nothing to like all of a sudden everybody's going to have an opinion on it.
Yeah.
And nothing really has changed. It's just people have become more aware. Mm-hmm. So it's like a 6-month thing. Literally last fall, there's nobody talking about this.
No.
And by next fall, everyone will need to have an opinion on it.
That's be,
are
Bitcoin
you like big blocker
do.
Or small blocker?
And the funny thing,
are you confiscate or not? Because Peter Woolla, I mean, who's one of the most decorated, obviously
amazing
developers ever in Bitcoin history, he said, "Of course, we have to confiscate them."
Hmm.
So there's already some really strong opinions.
If I was gonna bet on it as well, I think I would be on the side that would lose in that scenario. I think the most likely scenario, at least right now, and this will massively change, I'm sure, is that I think confiscate probably seems to have a bigger kind of sway.
So confiscate?
Yeah, I think so.
I think it's like they are, that the confiscate side is going to really need to get the majority of the opinion, because that's a much bolder action than to just let it be, right? So the confiscate side is really going to have to get massive consensus.
Yeah.
To win, whereas the other side simply can play a kind of like, you know, like let chaos reign and debate and argue and just kind of drag it out, you know, because they'll win if nothing happens, they win, right?
The narrative,
my point is the confiscate side is the one that has to do the change, right?
But the narrative on the confiscate side, I think, is an easier narrative to sell to most Bitcoiners, because I think a lot of Bitcoiners.
Do you think all these Wall Street people like Saylor? He's basically already said, as one of the largest holders and more powerful people in the ecosystem, right? He's already said he wants to burn his coins.
But I guess my point on the narrative side, though, is that I think most people in Bitcoin still just want number go up.
I see.
And I think the narrative on that side is stronger if you confiscate because you're not putting a million coins or whatever it is back into circulation.
Yeah, I mean, it is true that, yes, you're going to have a bunch of coins being sold. The price will temporarily go down, for sure. But I'm like, I guess I'm like, are you going to be not okay with that? I mean, that's just part of what would end up happening. I mean,
But you're certainly not a number go up maximalist. Like, well, that's not all you care about here.
Well, but Parker is, kind of, right? He's arguing that it's better for the economic value of the Bitcoin network long term.
But I think Parker's a better thinker than the vast majority of Bitcoiners. And right. I think he's thinking of second, third order consequences.
That's what I would be
not immediate
of.
Consequences.
Yeah, I just don't love the idea of getting political and having a small group of people decide.
Yeah.
What to do. That sounds like Ethereum.
Exactly, yeah.
So it'll be fascinating. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
That's not what we're here to talk about.
Really talk about, but I do appreciate getting to chat a little bit about it at the outset.
It's definitely interesting. But I want to talk very quickly before we get into this about Bedford.
Bedford was great.
It was incredible.
Thank you for having us, yeah.
Well, thank you for putting on such a cool, we had like over an hour of just HRF programming.
Worked well.
One of the coolest things that came out of the conference is that article in the Bedford Independent.
It was so cool.
So this is obviously like small local media, but he wrote an article basically saying this conference changed how I view financial freedom. I think he probably, by the sounds of it from the article, he came in thinking this was going to be a load of like Bitcoin bros and he left with a whole new perspective.
Yeah. Well, I think to credit you guys and especially the way you laid it out in the program, because it was about an hour, right? Mm-hmm. But you made it look like more than an hour.
Well, you had
when
a
you
lot
looked
stuff.
At the program, it looked like a small chunk in the morning, but it was probably like 2 hours, and then it was like a small chunk in the third part of the program, but it was really probably an hour and a half.
Yeah,
and then ours was bigger format wise because we had so many people.
Exactly.
But we like that format. It's a nice format. We've been experimenting a while. I'm talking about a 4 minute talk, basically. Mm-hmm. Where in an hour you can go through a ton of content. So we essentially had, I gave like a 20-minute talk to set the stage. And then we had, we'll call it a 15-minute fireside with like four people. And then we had a whole bunch of 4-minute talks. And then we had a closing fireside, I think, of like 12, 15 minutes. But we managed to go through like a dozen or even 14, 15 different perspectives in an hour. And I think people like that.
So
it's
powerful.
It's good content. I would encourage more people to steer that way with content generally. Like 4 minutes is a great short talk. You can work on it. You can convey an idea. It's very powerful. And the audience will learn something. You know, whereas you don't need a 45-minute talk necessarily. 4 minutes is to demonstrate an idea is pretty good. And I think we should be going more towards talks generally in conferences than panels. I mean, as a conference organizer who's been doing this for almost 20 years, like I understand the desire to do the panel is because you can fit all your friends or sponsors or whatever. Just like, we got to fit people here. And it can be okay if the moderator is really good.
Yeah.
Like, but you have to have, but usually they don't practice. It's not like people view a panel as something you can just stick people on if they're not ready or willing to give a talk, but I don't think that's smart because, you know, at the end of the day, it should be practiced and considered just as thoroughly as a talk if the panel's going to be good. And usually what happens is like the people meet backstage, they haven't practiced, they haven't done a phone call really, and they're just like, oh, okay, let's hang. And it's not that high impact, right?
I feel so seen. I've
done this, like, again, I've made this mistake many, many times. So we've kind of come around to the idea of like, we want to do fireside chats, which are ideally two or three people max, where the moderator has worked closely with the interviewees and knows what they're going to say, and it's powerful, and 4 minute talks. Or we have it's 12 to 15 minute keynote talk. So that's what you're going to see from us. But thank you for letting us do that. And obviously there was an impact. A lot of people were moved by it. Especially that journalist in particular said that his opinion was completely changed. So thanks for letting us partner on that. And we're gonna do more. You know, the day before we had launched this thing in London called the Bitcoin Humanitarian Alliance, which I've been talking with friends about for years. Because in our work at the Human Rights Foundation, we've been seeing Bitcoin rise as a humanitarian tool. And yet there's just not that much recognition of that in the media, right? In the mainstream media. So, or even really in the Bitcoin media to an extent. So what we did is we went to the Frontline Club, which is awesome. It's like where Julian Assange would leak stuff and announce things and many, many, many other very famous war reporters and investigative journalists. It's a very decorated place. You can feel the history in there. It's really cool. And there's just these awesome photographs and signed pieces by all different kinds of historic figures inside. And we launched the Bitcoin Humanitarian Alliance, which you can check out at bitcoinhumanalliance.org. And it's basically 12 organizations to start, which do different things around the world, ranging from like the civil liberties stuff that we do to Save the Children is involved, to a group that spreads classic liberal thought in the Arab world, to an environmentalist group in South America. So just different groups doing different things from a human rights or humanitarian perspective. But we all use Bitcoin operationally, and meaning we really use it. Like we receive it for donations, we hold it, we spend it, we allocate grants in it, we do payroll, et cetera, et cetera. So we all got a chance to talk to the audience about this and explain what we do. And the room was completely packed. It was standing room only. And there were tons of journalists there and policymakers. And it was a great launch. And then we just kind of got on a bus and went straight to Bedford, which was
That was the party bus. I saw that turn up and there's just like 30 Bitcoins piling out of this thing.
That was fun. So then, and then we tried to what we did is we gave everybody who spoke very briefly at the press conference in London, you know, a little bit longer to talk about their work. But no, it was great. And you can tell that people liked that. I was looking at some of the feedback and I think you guys did a good job designing a really nice balance of different kinds of content that appeals to the average person.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It's interesting that you say like the media is not covering this side of Bitcoin, and even like Bitcoin media, probably not enough. Do you think that's starting to change in like the classic mainstream media though? Because I saw recently the BBC went out and visited Gridless in Africa.
Yes.
They did a pretty pro Bitcoin mining
piece. That was awesome. Well, we can thank Ian Burrell for that.
He's amazing.
Who came with us on the trek in Africa a year and a half ago.
I didn't know he was involved with that piece though. For
the no, because he wrote the original piece in the media on what they were doing in Unheard.
Yeah.
And then that was what sparked the Economist piece. And that's what sparked wider interest in Gridless.
I see.
And I think we could credit Ian and some. I mean, obviously, we have to credit the Gridless team 95%.
Yeah.
But if you're going to credit anyone else, it'd be Ian, because he helped mainstream media start to understand how fascinating and transformative it was, what they're doing there. And then I think that led eventually to more media coverage. And they were on NPR, BBC. I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah.
In fact, the guy who wrote the piece for the BBC was in the room with us at the Alliance.
Oh, cool.
And now he's interested in this side of things. I gave him a quote. We'll see what happens. See if there's a story. But it's like, it was really interesting. He asked me, which is actually germane to what we're going to talk about. I think he asked me, does a lot of the Wall Street adoption of Bitcoin and the nation state adoption of Bitcoin betray the freedom money value proposition that you guys were speaking so passionately about on the stage? Because he saw us talk about how Bitcoin's a liberation tool, how it's peer-to-peer cash that can empower people. And he's basically like, isn't what's happening in Washington and in Wall Street betraying that? And I, of course, told him no. That this is part and parcel of what's going to happen along the journey, and that, you know. Oh, and he was asking about the danger of centralized exchanges and KYC, and I was like, well, we don't really touch that infrastructure with activism. We teach a very peer-to-peer way to use Bitcoin, where we're not entering our personal information to some giant database. We're doing real peer-to-peer movement of value. Pseudonymously through the Bitcoin network. People are not using Binance or Coinbase or whatever when they're doing the kind of work that the activists are doing. I guess in general, my thoughts to him are like, it's way easier to actually do this today than 10 years ago.
For sure.
Way easier. It's way easier to use Bitcoin as freedom money today than 10 years ago is the point. Way easier, without a question. And people are like complaining, and I get it. Like, well, what about the strategic Bitcoin reserve and MicroStrategy risk and BlackRock and IBIT. And this is all so concerning that all these huge institutions are getting into Bitcoin. But I, you know, it's kind of like, to me, it's like a manufactured concern, because the reality on the ground or on your phone or on your computer is that it's easier to use Bitcoin as freedom money than it was 10 years ago. So how do you explain that? If you're trying to argue that it's corrupting Bitcoin in some way or betraying its value set, show me the evidence. There is none. It's actually way easier to use today. And that's because the value's higher. It's more widely accepted. There's a bigger network effect. there's more people who've come into the field who are graphic designers or UX designers or product designers because of the higher value. And it's just like this feedback loop that keeps going and going and going.
This episode is brought to you by River, the best place for Bitcoiners and businesses to buy Bitcoin. With River, you can set up zero-fee recurring buys, making stacking sats effortless. And while you're waiting for the perfect buying opportunity, River lets you earn daily interest on your cash balance paid in Bitcoin, which outperforms most high-yield savings accounts. What really sets River apart is their unmatched dedication to security. You have peace of mind knowing that River has monthly proof of reserves and holds all Bitcoin in multi-sig cold storage. And with US-based phone support, you'll always have someone ready to help. To open an account, go to river.com/WBD and earn up to $100 in Bitcoin when you buy. That's river.com/WBD. This episode is brought to you by AnchorWatch. The thing that keeps me up at night is the idea of a critical error with my Bitcoin cold storage. This is where AnchorWatch comes in. With AnchorWatch, you're protected by their time-locked multi-sig vault and with your own A-plus rated Lloyds of London-backed insurance policy. You get to hold your keys, AnchorWatch holds the risk. Whether you're worried about inheritance planning, rent attacks, natural disasters, or your own mistakes, you're protected by AnchorWatch. Rates for fully insured custody start as low as 0.55% and are available for individual and commercial customers located in the US. Speak to AnchorWatch for a quote and for more details about your security options and coverage. Visit AnchorWatch.com today, which is AnchorWatch.com. I also want to give a quick shout out to the Human Rights Foundation's Financial Freedom Report. This is their weekly newsletter that drops every Thursday, and it covers how authoritarian regimes use money as a tool for control and how people are pushing back against that using privacy tools and, of course, Bitcoin. It's an amazing newsletter, it's pure signal, and you can subscribe for free at financialfreedomreport.org.
That's interesting, because I think they're really important questions that he asked you. And especially
great questions.
Yeah, and especially on like the nation, like I think what you're saying there, you may be able to convince me on my actual stance on this here, because in terms of whether nation state adoption actually threatens some of the kind of principles of Bitcoin, it's something I've been probably annoyingly on the fence about, because I don't exactly know. I see the concerns on both sides.
Totally.
So maybe we should start by getting you to give like a high level overview of the talk you did
sure.
in Bedford.
Sure. And just to finish the last piece, let's credit Gridless for starting to get some of these journalists interested in the humanitarian, human side of Bitcoin.
Yeah. Right? That narrative is very strong.
And it starts maybe with the environment piece, mm-hmm. with the mining. Which is fascinating, because at the end of the day, electricity is human rights.
Yeah.
If you don't have electricity, you don't have freedom.
Yeah.
So I think it makes sense that it starts foundationally there with the work that like groups like Gridless are doing, and you're going to see a lot more of that. And that's where the journalists might start to be like, oh, that's kind of interesting. But to your original point, you still very, very rarely see a story in the media about Bitcoin being used for human rights, mm-hmm. for activism. There's very, very few in the mainstream media on this. Almost none recently.
The only one I could think of recently was when the Ukraine war started. There was a lot of talk about
it. Yeah, but that was 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of talk about that. But it's like that hasn't gone away. Mm-hmm. In fact, that those use cases have just gotten even stronger. And the ability to send Bitcoin into war zones and conflict zones and to help people where no one else can is unparalleled. Doing it myself the other day. It's just like amazing how easy it is. And, you know, so the point is we did the launch and I think it did well, and now there's a resource for any nonprofit around the world that wants to get more involved in Bitcoin. They can contact the Alliance. We can put them in touch with one of the experts in the Alliance, and people can start to do more. You know, it's our goal, at least at the Human Rights Foundation. Last year, we onboarded close to 200 movements and civil society organizations and human rights groups worldwide.
Amazing.
This year, we want to get to 1,000, so we're on our way. And I think that's significant because it's not like you're just onboarding a person. Each individual taking one of our webinars, for example, that we do every quarter that are free and online, or doing a private training with us, teaches then their group, mm-hmm. which might be 10 people and might be a million people. I mean, some of the people we work with are part of enormous national organizations, right? So it's quite exciting. I mean, I'm not going to name names for different reasons. Some of these organizations are funded by millions of people who subscribe to them, and those people may not have a particularly positive viewpoint of Bitcoin right now. So some of these groups are not going to be public about how they use Bitcoin.
I can imagine the kind of groups you're talking
about.
Yes,
but I can tell you that these are brand names and they're using Bitcoin. You know, not Greenpeace, but well, actually probably Greenpeace. Yeah. Maybe Greenpeace in India. But groups like that are using it. It's just you might not hear about it, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. There's no who cares? It's not needed. The important point is they're realizing it's the best way to move money or value from A to B. But yeah, so I gave this new talk at the conference, which coincided with the publication of a new book that I have that's, you know, it's not a widely available one. We made it. I worked with Skylar Westby, the designer. He's amazing. And he did this beautiful anthology of all of my writings. And we called it A Trojan Horse for Freedom, which is one of the chapters of Check Your Financial Privilege, a book that I came out with and was writing in 2019, 2020, 2021. It came out in early 2022. So 3 years ago it came out. But the original essay was written 4 years ago in early 2021. And idea of the original essay was that Bitcoin was a Trojan horse for freedom, just like the original Trojan horse was a subtle way that that the Greek forces could gain access to the city of Troy, where brute force didn't work. So we go back to the sly roundabout way quote. I think it was Milton Friedman. He said that, you know, basically the fiat credit super system that emerged after the 1960s and 70s that has taken over the world with all of its different arms, the euro dollar, the petrodollar, all these different things, you're not going to defeat that by force. You're not going to defeat it in a, you know, brute attack. It's going to have to be a sly roundabout way.
I think right? It was Hayek.
It was Hayek. Okay, you're right. You're right. It was Hayek. So sly roundabout way is Bitcoin, right? So my thesis was, and of course it was inspired by writings that had been on Bitcoin Talk a decade earlier. People had been playing with this idea, but I tried to put it into a framework of, again, just like the Greeks, it was impossible for them to take Troy. So Minerva implants this idea in Ulysses' head to, you know, build this massive horse and, you know, leave one soldier behind with this beautiful thing in the war field outside of the city. And the Trojans looked at it and they were like, well, that's kind of cool. And a couple of the Trojans were like, no, this is obviously a trick. Don't bring it in. But they were dismissed and they brought the horse in. And of course, at night, the Greeks come out of the horse and open the gates and the army that was hidden, you know, comes inside. They take the city. So it's an example of how something can use trickery or subterfuge to win as opposed to just brute force. So I think that Bitcoin is a Trojan horse for freedom in as much as the people who control the existing system willingly let in the Bitcoin because they see NGU or number go up technology and they're greedy or self-interested, which is totally fine. I understand why. But what they don't see is that they're empowering the freedom go up technology that's inside. Mm-hmm. So that's the thesis of the essay. And we turn that into a book that includes a bunch of stuff from Check Your Financial Privilege, from my second book, Hidden Repression, where again, you're going to see this, like basically that the IMF and World Bank system, it can't be defeated, you know, in a war or whatever. It only has to be a sly roundabout way. And I do think that way is going to be Bitcoin because people can peacefully opt out from that system today, whereas they couldn't before. Like if you were in the 1980s and you were being structurally adjusted in one of these countries and your wages were crashing and you were over time able to buy with your hours of your labor, even though you were getting maybe more efficient at your job, you were buying less and less rice or milk or wheat or whatever, or certainly gold or real estate with each hour of your time because of these structural adjustment policies. This is insane because the technology you were getting paid in, the wage technology, was being crushed. Mm-hmm. Today, you can escape that. You can convert your wages into Bitcoin, and over time, they can become stronger in terms of purchasing power. So there's a way out there. And then I also included some other essays, but we basically packaged this thing up and then we used some of the imagery that Skylar created to do a presentation at Bedford. So it was the human rights paradox of nation state Bitcoin adoption was what I gave the talk on. And again, we begin with, you know, the idea of separation of money and state. Hey, isn't this what we were going for? What's the deal? why are governments getting involved? This is sketchy. I'm worried. This is what people are talking about.
That's probably the thing that I've been most stuck
on. Yeah, and what the funniest thing to me, and we made a cool chart of it. It's like kind of how the arguments have changed over time. At first, people were like ignoring Bitcoin, and they're like, this is not going to work. And then they're like, well, it's too slow, or it uses too much, you know, energy or whatever. Finally, they're like, no, governments are just going to ban it. Okay. Now the worry for a lot of people is that governments are going to adopt it, which I just find hilarious. Like, okay, so, and then at the end you win, you know, sort of like the thing, you know, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win, right? So it's sort of the idea. So the point I wanted to try and make is that you can't have a technology like Bitcoin that you believe will eventually be peer-to-peer money for the world or some sort of savings technology for anybody and choose who uses it. Mm-hmm. Its power is in its permissionless nature and its failure to be able to discriminate. That's its superpower. And I'm sorry, but there's just no world where Bitcoin becomes like a dominant global currency where large institutions and nation states don't adopt it. And my point is that almost this is sort of, if there was, you know, a plan, there's obviously no plan, but if you look at Bitcoin like an organism that's growing, this is part of how it grows because it basically takes over these large institutions and transforms them. It's kind of like calling it like a virus is not the ideal metaphor because
that's pretty good.
But because it's a fungus, right? Because it's a positive thing. But when you think about some of these fungi that take over insects, right? Mm-hmm. Then you see like the skull break out, right? Some people eat those in tea, by the way, the Tibetans. It's kind of interesting. Cordyceps. It's the plot line for Last of Us, right? Many of these zombie thrillers. But the point is, that's what it's doing. It's taking over the institutions and transforming them is the idea. So it's like a freedom virus is the idea. So my point is you're not, I'm sorry, but there's no world where Bitcoin does really well, it succeeds, and it's wonderful freedom technology for cypherpunks. But nobody that you don't like is allowed to use it.
Of course, this is money for enemies.
Yeah, exactly. So my point is that this was always the plan, or at least this was always the way it was going to go. If Bitcoin were to succeed, it had to be adopted by nation states and it had to be adopted by institutions. It was the only way. You can't get from here to here without it in the middle happening in some way. So while I don't necessarily think we need to sit here and cheer individual actions, we do need to recognize that this is a symbol of or a signal of its success, not its failure. A signal of Bitcoin's failure would be nobody's using it, and there is no nation state adoption, and there is no corporate adoption, and it remains a niche technology with no value that a handful of people use. That would be a pretty good signal of failure, right? That's not what we're seeing. Like, we're seeing this thing go from a few million dollars to $2 trillion. We're seeing it being adopted by Wall Street and governments. And at the same time, they aren't able to neuter its power. That's the key, right? So if we're sitting here and it was impossible for me now to send you, Danny, a peer-to-peer payment with Bitcoin where someone could selectively see that I'm making the payment and say, I don't want Alex to do that, and they could censor it, okay, then I would agree we've failed. But that's not at all what's happening here. In fact, far from it. I know we have our issues with mining centralization, which we're actively trying to work against at HRF, and other things, but that's just not the world we're living in. Like, not only can I send you an on-chain transaction where no one can stop us, partly because they don't know it's us. Like, that's the beauty of the permissionless part of it. Unless I literally pair my real world identity with an on-chain address, they don't know. And even if I do that, they can only make assumptions. Mm-hmm. But if we are just doing like a cash trade, I mean, they have no freaking idea who we are. It's just, you know, but that's not even counting all the new technology that's come in.
E-cash.
I mean, even just take something like the Aqua wallet, which, you know, I think is a work in progress. But I mean, you can like send on-chain Bitcoin there and swap it into liquid Bitcoin and then send it to, you know, someone on Lightning. I mean, it's just like there's all these swaps involved where it's not possible to tell what's going on, right? And that's not even talking about eCash. You know, you can go to Boardwalk Cash now, send a little bit of Bitcoin and create a perfectly private bearer instrument currency that then you can trade around. So I think clearly privacy tech has improved so much in Bitcoin versus 10 years ago. It's actually usable on mobile devices, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm excited by the fact that even as we get more global adoption, this thing's power as a freedom tool continues to grow. And I would need to see a serious decline in people's ability to use this thing as a freedom tool for me to admit that my thesis was wrong.
Yeah.
So my thesis, again, is that Bitcoin's a Trojan horse for freedom, that there is no real paradox of nation state adoption from a human rights point of view. It's kind of a false paradox. This is how we separate money from state, is we get everybody to adopt it. And if you get enough people to adopt it, they'll realize one day that they can no longer print the money in the same way that they can today. Mm. So I put up a slide at the end of my talk of Uncle Sam symbolizing fiat money creation from central banks. And he's sitting on a branch of a tree and he's sawing off the branch that he's sitting on. So this is the idea. Like the Trump administration is establishing an SBR. I mean, regardless of how much Bitcoin they have, where they're getting it from, how big it is, it doesn't matter. Like, that's clearly not good long-term for the idea of the dollar as a money and a savings instrument. Anyone who says otherwise is just fooling themselves. They're like, oh, this is going to be good for the dollar to back it with Bitcoin. What are you talking about? Like, this is them giving a jolt to a competitor.
Mm.
I would agree, a self-inflicted wound. Why are they doing it? I'm not quite sure, but I think it's great. Like, you know, the idea that you should be, I mean, from a pure perspective of, we need to get to a world where people are able to use Bitcoin as their money, to be their own bank, to do transactions, to pay merchants, even to pay taxes. You need to recognize things like the SBR and nation state mining adoption and corporate adoption as part of the road to get there.
Yeah.
That's it.
I want to lay out some of my kind of tentative concerns. But before I do that, one thing that I think is really interesting is the supply schedule of Bitcoin plays exactly into your thesis, I think. The fact that by the time we had like real Wall Street adoption ETFs a little over a year ago, we had 15 years to front run this thing with a massive amount of supply. I don't know, 85% of the supply was already there.
More than 90 now, right?
More than 90 now, yeah. So I think that's really cool in terms of like promoting this grassroots adoption. But one of the things that I think hasn't sit perfectly with me is the incentives behind the US doing this. And let me explain why. So when El Salvador did it, they had like first mover advantage. The incentive for them to do that's pretty clear. Like, they were at the whim of the Fed, but with none of the kind of perceived benefits of the Fed. On like the Bhutan side, a relatively poor nation with tons of hydro, mining made perfect sense for them. What my concern with the US doing it is, I don't exactly know their incentive for doing it. And it's now becoming part of like the geopolitical game. So even if like long-term, I would probably agree that this is, I mean, it's certainly inevitable. It's probably going to be a good thing for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
It's like, what happens in the interim while they're kind of like toying with this as a geopolitical thing?
It's hard to know. It seems like a lot of people at the top of the administration don't know the difference between Bitcoin and crypto.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Milei, obviously in Argentina, has no idea. I mean, he thinks any private money that's outside the state's control is great.
Yeah.
He doesn't care if it's the worst shitcoin in the world. He's happy to smile and take a picture with it.
I mean, yes, seriously. That's clear.
It seems like people at the top of the Trump administration get the difference in the same way that a lot of like influencers on crypto Twitter seem to get the difference. Whereas right now, when you're kind of in this crazy bear market for altcoins, but Bitcoin as of our recording is at almost $89,000, you know, extremely bullish Bitcoin, right? Mm-hmm. But very bearish on some of these altcoins, which are below their 2017 highs, right? Or at least way below their 2021 high.
Mm-hmm.
Even Solana, which is considered like, you know, the best performing major altcoin at this point, is at like what? It's like 120 or 130.
And I don't even know.
Its peak was like but its peak was way beyond 200.
And then you put it compared to Bitcoin, it's even worse.
Right. No. All of these coins have done poorly over the last cycle compared to Bitcoin, which surprised me. I thought it was going to take a couple cycles, but I mean, I knew they were all going to go to zero against Bitcoin, but it's just a question of, it's been kind of surprising to me to see the separation in the last few months. And I think that colors the market, that colors the commentators, the pundits, and it colors the government. You know, because, you know, let's say, so you've been placed, as David Sachs has, as like the AI and crypto czar. Well, really, like when you remove Bitcoin, what are you really the czar of? but I think they were confused. I mean, look, this one of the sons of Trump was pumping ETH at the beginning of February. So anyone following his advice has lost like half their money, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah.
So clearly, like, I think the people on the inside didn't really have, they weren't on the same page on this. What they had was a bunch of Bitcoin that was that they had from confiscation. So there's moral issues there. And they were basically going to say, I guess they didn't lose anything by saying we're going to make this a reserve. But they were getting pushed in that direction by so many people. But people have to realize that's the product of democracy. Like, you can't, it was really funny. I think someone on Twitter the other day was saying, you know, the US dollar was doing so well. Like, why did, you know, if it hadn't been for the Trump administration and the tariff thing and the Mar-a-Lago Accord, the dollar would be just as strong as it was, you know, before. But you can't say that. They are a product of the system, right? So politicians are a product of the system. They're connected to the economy. If you have enough inequality and if you have enough real wage loss over time, people get pissed and they elect populists into power, whether they be right wing or left wing. You're either going to have a Bernie Sanders or a Trump. You're going to have someone who's going to say, I'm going to fight for you and I'm going to take back what they took from you.
Mm-hmm.
One way or the other, whether you're coming from this kind of sort of more nationalistic, nativist point of view like Trump, or more of a socialist point of view where it's a class war thing. It's either a, you know, us versus them, you know, foreign versus domestic, or it's an us versus them class war thing.
Yeah.
So it's really clear that when economic conditions become difficult over time, at least over the last 100 years, when inequality is the highest and when the average person's doing relatively not as great as they were in the previous cycle, populism gets more popular. You can just see this. It was really popular in the 20s and 30s. Now it's getting popular again. It was not popular in the 50s and 60s. So it's really interesting to watch this. But the point is that the politicians are like a product of the system in many ways, right? So in that sense, yeah, I mean, the system in the Bitcoin space is that they're reacting to is that, yeah, Bitcoin is taking this sort of surprising, strong dominance in the Bitcoin crypto dominance indicator stuff, where a lot of these coins are just clearly going to zero. And yeah. I think people are starting to understand that. I don't think we're out of the woods yet, clearly. I think there will always be cryptos in as much as there are penny stocks today that people love to trade and mess around with. There's always going to be that. But I think the you know, maybe the age of like, oh, here's my token white paper. I hope that's over. I mean, I don't know if it is, but I mean, the world coin might have been the last big, giant, unbelievably crazy scam, you know? I say that, and we just had a Trump and Melania scam, you know? So I want to say we're moving in the right direction, but we're not out of the woods yet,
yeah,
right?
The scams have changed, though. Like, it's gone from
they're more obvious now.
They're more obvious, yeah. I think the big change will be when the VCs in Silicon Valley realize that Bitcoin's the only thing to care about.
Yeah, but they can still see if they can still eke out their kind of
time to liquidity kind of,
yeah, if they can still dump on the market even a little bit, they're still going to do it. So even though obviously nobody actually thought Melania coin was going to be worth anything in the near future, there was an ability to create Melania coin and have seniorage, essentially, like create it for cost of X,
yeah,
and dump it for cost of Y, where Y was higher than X, and take the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And people are going to do that until that gap goes away. And it may never really fully go away, right? So I think you're always going to see that stuff. But I think, again, the games have changed a little bit. As you point out, it's no longer like, oh, yeah, here's our new like cryptographically secure privacy token that you need. Let me explain to you in 7 white papers why it's important.
It's like, now it's like Pikachu is at a protest.
Yeah, now no. Well, now it's like Fartcoin.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's not important cryptographically, but yeah, like, you know, maybe people will ape into it. So we'll see. But I do feel like there's this moment where the government is starting to grasp that Bitcoin is different. And that's a slow thing that the whole world is going to go through that, right? And the only way to, in many ways, the only way to go through that process is to burn your hand on the stove, right? Which people have done at all levels. I mean, a lot of these corporations that now have Bitcoin stuff, they lost a lot of money on altcoins at one point or another, right? So, you know, I guess we'll see. But I mean, to your point about the concerns, like, you know, and what is driving these people, I certainly don't think they understand that Bitcoin could. I don't know. So Luke Roman has this interesting thesis that he thinks what we're going to do is kind of tank the market a bit, tank the dollar, tank treasuries. This is all happening, by the way, as we speak, right? I mean, the Dixie is like in the 90s, like it's plummeting. Tank general economic activity happening. Check all these boxes of his thesis, which is why it's interesting. And get China to buy gold, lots of gold happening. And then kind of rug them with Bitcoin, which is a very interesting thesis. I mean, I think you would see the price go like that kind of buying of Bitcoin would, I just would imagine would be putting us into the triple digits solidly, but I have no idea, you know? But so I don't think we're quite there yet, but it's an interesting thesis. We're just going to rug China with real gold, with digital gold, as opposed to the analog kind. Let them buy all the analog gold. Go for it. And then we're just going to pump Bitcoin. That's what he's basically recommending we do, which is really interesting.
If there was one person that I thought would have a plan like that, I could believe that the Trump administration would go for it.
Yeah, maybe.
The problem that I have with that is I'm with you in that I don't think the Trump administration truly understand Bitcoin. So yeah. I don't think that's maybe likely. But I hope it is true because that'd be amazing. What a timeline. But with the, like BPI have done some amazing work in terms of getting good information to the Trump administration. A lot of their work has come down to Bitcoin actually solidifying the US dollar. I don't know if that again is like another Trojan horse really just to get Bitcoin.
I don't get that one.
Yeah.
But what I do appreciate what BPI is doing is they are helping the government understand the value of Bitcoin. But at the same time, they are unapologetically pushing for, one of the few groups pushing for the P2P private nature of Bitcoin.
Yes.
Like they have a fund you can donate to help the Samurai case, for example, which is one of the most important cases right now in the world for Bitcoin, which is the ability to, again, use open source software that allows people to achieve privacy in Bitcoin. And currently the U.S., under the previous regime, the U.S. government was going after these tool builders like the blacksmith in a stabbing, right? So if I make a knife and you stab that person over there with it, in today's criminal justice system, I don't get in trouble because I made a knife and I'm selling them for you to cut your meat with,
it's a tool,
and chop up bread.
Yeah.
What the U.S. government was trying to do was go after these tool builders and try to tar them with the crime. So ethically, this makes no sense at all. Legally, I mean, you know. So thankfully, it seems like we're moving in a better direction. Okay, so Phoenix, which is a wonderful Lightning mobile app that I recommend people check out.
It's awesome. They're back in the U.S. now.
Yeah, they left the U.S. a year ago, which was scary. And I, you know, a lot of people are like, well, they shouldn't have left. Whatever. That's not my decision to make. Yeah. I don't work there. I don't have, you know, there are a lot of personal concerns that come with like this. And we're seeing these concerns now.
And like, they're a French company that...
Yeah.
Like if the developer of that thinks that he may get in trouble with you, like I understand.
Well, they may have employees in the U.S. and look what the Trump administration is doing now with like foreigners in the U.S.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So I get it, but the good news is they're back, meaning they've deemed it safe to be here, which is wonderful. I think America should be a safe place for people to develop freedom technology. And I think PPI is pushing for that.
Yeah.
Which is super commendable. Now, at the same time, they're engaging the U.S. and teaching them about the value of it. You know, I don't know. I mean, if you look at the monetary history piece, like, I guess there is a world where maybe it makes sense that, so we went from a gold standard to a dollar standard backed by gold to a dollar standard backed by nothing. Well, really oil, but, you know, no gold at least. It makes sense that we would go from pure gold to dollar backed by gold to just pure dollar, maybe to dollar backed by Bitcoin, and then eventually
Bitcoin.
Now, people should note that the dollar backed by gold standard lasted for about 15 years. Like, basically, it was kind of like proposed. And what I mean by this is like governments settling dollars with each other instead of gold. So like previous to like World War One, you know, obviously there were fiat currencies, but governments didn't settle with those fiat currencies. What was promoted after World War II in 44 at Bretton Woods was the idea of settling in dollars, not settling in gold, settling in dollars. So all of a sudden you had this massive exportation of dollars to the world and countries were settling their trade balances with each other, buying and selling things with dollars. So that really took a little while to get implemented. So it was 44. So it was like, it was really the early to mid 50s when it was actually being used and implemented. And it started to break down in the early to mid 60s and it was completely broken by 71. So anywhere from 15 to 20 years is how long the like dollars backed by gold actually lasted, right? So maybe we could expect something similar where policymakers try to recognize Bitcoin's value and maybe say, hey, we're going to back our currency with it. Maybe that's what they're doing. I mean, maybe they actually believe this. I don't, it's clearly not going to last very long though, because why would I want your dollar backed by Bitcoin when I can just have Bitcoin? Mm-hmm. With gold, it was different. Like it's just completely impractical for you and I to do transactions, especially in the modern age with gold.
For sure.
It's a rock. And even back then, it was not that practical because we had the telegram, we had the phone, we had the airplane. I mean, what are you going to put something on a boat and send it to Europe? It's ridiculous. And they did try. The French tried to take their gold back from America in the summer of 71, one of the things that precipitated, you know, the Nixon shock. But this idea that gold was going to be the currency just was never workable. Like Lynn Alden does a great job explaining this in her book, like the scientific evolution of money. Like gold was like 100 times going to lose to fiat just because it can't teleport, among other reasons. But now that we have this other system, why would I want your, it's kind of like, why would you, you know, why would a Bitcoiner who understands Bitcoin truly and deeply, why would they want MSTR or like IBIT? Now, maybe they're forced to have some for tax reasons or something like that, maybe. But like they want self-custodied Bitcoin in the same way that like everybody else is going to want that too.
The MicroStrategy one maybe is a little different because it's essentially
you
like
can get leverage.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. But like as far as a long-term savings play.
Correct.
Meaning if you have like your family's wealth and then you have like maybe some money for speculation. Yeah, maybe you play with the derivatives with the speculation. But you shouldn't be putting all your savings or reserves in MSTR. No. Like that's not what it's for. It's literally as Saylor says, it's to basically gamble with the price of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Like you can get a lot more volatility out of MSTR than you can of spot Bitcoin, right? Now IBIT might be slightly different because of laws and regulations. It's hard for institutions to just like custody Bitcoin themselves.
Yep.
Maybe it's even not permitted by their board or whatever. But guess what? They can buy IBIT. So we're going through a little bit of a transformational phase there. But the point is, there could be this interregnum where it's like, okay, maybe some fiats start to like essentially have a reserve of Bitcoin and try to base their fiat on that. But it's like an asset liability mismatch in the end. And it's like ultimately, like it's like the Terra Luna thing. It's like eventually it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. If you have Bitcoin and dollars, and most people who've studied this understand this doesn't really work. So maybe it can last for a while. And maybe we will have an age of like governments holding Bitcoin and still using their fiats. Who knows how long that will last? But at the end of the day, it's like the, you know, so you kind of have the Gresham's Law thing now, right? Where generally speaking, I know it's not a perfect reading of Gresham's Law, but you get the idea, is that the bad money drives out the good. And this comes from the age of kings and coin clipping, where you'd have circulating metal money in society, and the devious king would clip a little bit of the gold or the silver out of the coin and have it reforged and pretend, you know, and not say anything about it, recirculate it. People aren't dumb. They would weigh it, and they would realize the heavier one is worth more, and they would save the heavier ones, and they would try to spend the cheap ones, right? Because it was all nominally the same.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, same thing today. Like, nominally, you know, $1 of Bitcoin might be worth $1 of paper money, but people aren't stupid. They're going to save the Bitcoin and try to spend the fiat. Now, eventually, you get to a different economic paradigm, which is the Thiers Law thing, which is that the good money drives out the bad completely. And that's what happens in dollarizing countries, right? So it's true that people in Venezuela want to save in dollars, but guess what? The merchants don't want the bolivars. Mm-hmm. They want the dollars too. So they're not going to allow you to pay in bolivars. No, take your wheelbarrow somewhere else. Give me dollars. So once merchants and maybe tax authorities at some point demand Bitcoin, it's over for the fiat currencies. People are going to want Bitcoin. Now, maybe those are Bitcoin-denominated credits. Maybe. Maybe that's something like eCash or even some sort of government-issued fiat credit or whatever. But they're not going to want a dollar. They're not going to want a fiat-denominated thing is my point.
Yeah.
And that's where we kind of would eventually go to is my sort of general, I think, thesis. So maybe there's this, maybe there's this time where you have both. You know, fiat's backed by Bitcoin, but eventually people are going to be like, why would I want that? You're going to have to pay me a lot more, you know, meaning if I'm a merchant and I'm going to sell you something, there's a lot more risk involved in a credit instrument of Bitcoin than just the pure thing.
So especially considering at this point, it would most likely be a hyperinflating fiat currency as well.
Well, or just like the risk of having a not the real thing.
Yeah.
I mean, we see that in eCash. Like, I think eCash is a wonderful technology. We're happy to support it. Like, you should never have more than like a few $100 of eCash.
Yeah.
It's
just your spending wallet.
Yeah. And because you can get rugged, mm-hmm. even in the Fedi Mint variety. Harder to do so, but like you should never treat any sort of eCash type thing as a replacement for like
real Bitcoin.
Hardcore Bitcoin. Yeah. Now, with things like ARC, it gets interesting where, you know, Lightning is real Bitcoin, right? Mm-hmm. Where like you have unilateral control over it. You can't get rugged really if you're using Lightning properly. Now, if ARC can do the same thing, and we're going to see because it's coming into production, there is more interactivity with ARC and some other things, but essentially it promises some kind of trustless way to use Bitcoin that's cheaper and faster and more private, even than Lightning, right? So maybe even better for purchasing things. Well, that gets really interesting. So we'll see. But I'm talking about credits. So like side chains, things like Liquid, things like eCash, obviously custodially generated derivatives like IBIT, company shares that are basically shares of companies holding Bitcoin. You know, I understand the leverage plays, but eventually you would think that those things would trade at a discount to the real thing. I mean, we'll see. You do see that already in a way with like fully non-KYC private Bitcoin. It tends to trade higher than normal Bitcoin.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. So I think maybe once the market sort of figures this out, which they haven't yet, obviously, I think that may make sense. Like, yeah, just think about it. You as a merchant, like in 20 years, like, are you going to want, because hey, Danny, I'll pay you in this like kind of sketchy derivative of Bitcoin, or I could pay you in the real thing. What are you going to be like? I'll take the shitty derivative.
Yeah.
No, I would have to pay you more.
Of course.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, you're not an idiot. Like, so it's just going to take a while, but that's kind of where we're going, I would say.
This episode is brought to you by Casa, the leading Bitcoin self-custody solution. I've been using Casa since 2019, and I can't recommend them enough. Casa have options for all Bitcoiners, from a 2 of 3 multisig to a 3 of 5 and a private client option for absolute best-in-class security. Casa also do inheritance, which I very recently set up, and it really couldn't be easier. My inheritance plan has gone from a vague treasure map for my wife to a rock-solid security plan that I have total confidence in. To find out more about Casa, go to casa.io, which is casa.io. This episode is also brought to you by Ledger. If you're serious about protecting your Bitcoin, Ledger has the solution you need. Their hardware wallets give you complete control over your private keys, ensuring that your Bitcoin stays safe from hacks, phishing, and malware. With Ledger's easy-to-use devices and the Ledger Live app, managing your Bitcoin has never been more convenient. Whether you're a long-time holder or new to the world of Bitcoin, Ledger makes it simple to keep your assets protected. If you want to find out more, visit ledger.com and secure your Bitcoin today. That's ledger.com.
So I think maybe the one piece that we haven't talked about here that I think fits into it very closely is like the stablecoin side.
Mm-hmm.
Just quickly before we get onto that though, earlier you were talking about the IMF and World Bank. You obviously wrote a book on the IMF. What has to happen to kind of neuter those organizations? Like, at what point mm-hmm. do they become less, I guess, what's the word? Kind of pervasive in what they're doing?
Well, I mean, look, these institutions which exist to enrich the creditors at the expense of the borrowers, both economically and politically, That's what they've been doing for 50 plus years, as I outline in my book. They basically take advantage of other countries and their resources. And it's usually a small group of advanced rich countries taking advantage of what is called the global majority, or the global majority of people and resources live in a certain number of countries, you know, often called the global south, the third world, et cetera. I think Bitcoin changes that eventually by just bankrupting that way of doing things. Like, mm-hmm. that way of doing things is fully financed by fiat, where there's this currency caste system, and basically credit money can be issued more cheaply by rich countries, and it can be sold essentially to poor countries at a much more expensive rate, locking them into an ever-increasing debt trap, where these countries borrow in dollars, essentially, or maybe like euros or even RMB, depending on who's issuing. And then the other country's currency performs way worse over time, but they can't pay back the loan in their own currency. They have to pay it back in dollars. And what's more, they need dollars for everything else in the world. They need it to buy energy. They need it to buy fertilizer, to import grain, to buy heavy machinery, to advance their civilization, to buy any kind of new power systems, nuclear, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we have a situation today where some countries can print the money to do those things, a very small handful, but most countries cannot. Most countries have to acquire those dollars elsewhere, and they can do that in a few ways. They can borrow them from like the IMF or whatever, which causes them to have to change their political system, usually in a not so great way for the people who have to live there. I mean, they can issue bonds on the open market, but those tend to be, like, especially now, not that well subscribed.
Yeah.
I mean, who's going to want essentially international junk bonds right now? For some peoples, it's completely impossible. Like, who would buy a Palestinian bond? Mm-hmm. Nobody. Clearly that's not going to end well. You know, you could insert the name of any other sort of more country in a difficult situation.
Yeah, one Malawi, of the countries.
Who's going to buy a Malawian bond? Nobody. Exactly. They can't even issue them.
And one of the countries in the book that you talk about is Bangladesh, and like, no one's going to buy a Bangladesh
bond. It would just be like so, there would be so little demand for it, so cheap. So if borrowing is a bad idea and private market borrowing's not really working very well, what can you do? You can do trade with countries that have dollars to earn the dollars. And what they end up doing is transforming their countries and their economies. Bangladesh is a great example, to making things that we want instead of things that they need.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way the system works now. So if we had a Bitcoin standard, this would start to break down, because countries like Bangladesh could harness their significant abundant renewable resources to mine Bitcoin and to generate a marginal amount of Bitcoin that they could use unilaterally without asking permission from anybody, to whatever it is they need to do. Buy oil. This is my thesis, that in the future, oil exporters will accept Bitcoin. Maybe they need to buy machinery. My thesis is that like Boeing and like these large industrial giants will accept Bitcoin. And at first their jurisdictional overseers will say no. Like at first, the Trump administration would probably be like, no, we don't want you to accept Bitcoin, Boeing. But guess what? There's a massive lobbying system, and Boeing is going to lobby and bribe its way to being able to accept Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So it's like the system works against itself in this way. It's like sawing the branch off, basically. Yeah. So eventually, you know, a country like Bangladesh can, with Bitcoin, buy what it needs. It can even borrow in a less kind of a permissioned way. It can have some collateral to do stuff with. You know, one thing is borrowing from the IMF. Another thing is using your Bitcoin or your potential Bitcoin reserves that you're going to mine in the future with as a bond of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's just going to be way more ways for these countries to develop.
I think that
breaks the system. That's what breaks the system, and it starts to transfer that economic activity to a new system. But that takes place gradually. But it's very clear to me that's a possibility. I mean, we already know it's a possibility for the individual or for the small organization. If you're Bitcoin native, you can't be structurally adjusted.
Yeah.
Period. You have escaped. Your wages are safe. So the question is, can the whole nation escape it? And I think it can. It's just like, it's going to take time.
Mm-hmm. I think, because obviously one of the dynamics here is they can't pay back the initial loan, so then they have to take a bigger loan,
exactly.
Of which a portion of that is used to pay back the initial loan.
Yeah.
And so this is the debt trap.
But this is enforced by the different currencies.
Yeah.
So, but you have to understand, like, the Egyptian leaders, they have dollar access. They just borrowed $1 billion or $2 or $3 billion that they use to buy things on the international markets. But the people of Egypt don't have dollars.
Of course.
In fact, it may be even illegal. In Ethiopia, it's legal to have dollars. So they force you into their crappy local currency, and then they devalue it and devalue it and devalue it. So you get poorer and impoverished, right, over time, instead of getting richer and more advanced, which is what we should be getting given deflationary effects, Jeff Booth, technology, all this stuff. Fiat breaks that ability for the country to progress along with technology. Mm-hmm. It robs people and it impoverishes them. So that's only possible because we have this, whatever it is, 170, 180 currency caste system. Now, it wouldn't be perfect in a Bitcoin standard at all, but it would be much more tightly connected in terms of wages in different countries, in terms of capital flows, in terms of countries' ability to make decisions unilaterally without having to ask permission from their bigger neighbors. It definitely smooths things out. And I think that's, my evidence there is based on, again, it starts grassroots and grows bigger. It's already making it way easier for individuals and families and small businesses to opt out completely of the old system. They can earn in a new technology. They can send and receive permissionlessly. They can mine. They can transform the energy around their property into this thing. They can even now start to borrow against it. They have financial markets. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. So the question is, does that continue to advance and progress and sort of metastasize into a nation state level transformation? And, I think it will over time.
The other interesting part of that is, like, if you use Bhutan as an example, now I don't know if they take loans from the IMF, but just in this scenario, assume they did.
Yeah.
Because they're mining Bitcoin, which is hard money that can't be debased, it goes up in value, they also are less likely to fall into the debt trap because they have that to fall back on to pay off initial loans. I would have a question for you as well on El Salvador.
Well, it's interesting just on that note. I mean, I think Bhutan did not necessarily want to disclose its plans at first.
It was Celsius,
They were leaked in a case, and all of a sudden people are like, wow, they have $1 billion of Bitcoin or whatever. Because they still do borrow money. Mm. Again, we're in this transitional time, this interregnum, right? Where the old system is dying, but the new one can't be born yet.
Yeah.
That's a quote from Gramsci. So it's old system's dying, Bhutan is still on the, still borrowing, but, they're starting to participate in this new system. Mm. But it's not super clean yet. It's going to be a little rocky. But unquestionably, they're in a much better position today.
Of course.
If you look at Norway, Norway started a sovereign wealth fund in the late 90s that was worth $200 million. Today, it's worth $2 trillion. So, and their currency's still collapsing. Imagine if they hadn't done that. Mm-hmm. Now, we're talking about an opportunity today in 2025 for any nation to do what Norway did. Now, Norway has a sovereign wealth fund today that is the equivalent of $300,000 per citizen. It's crazy. There's all that math making fun of people for saying, oh, this is going to be $100,000 per person. No, this is real. If you divide trillions by Norway's small population, you get $200,000 to $300,000 per person. Now, that's because they were very smart. They invested very carefully. They even have some MicroStrategy apparently. Huh. So, they took their oil wealth and they did something smart with it instead of most dictators do, just blow it.
It's funny that you say, imagine if they didn't do that. Cause I think at the time, I don't know when this exactly
poor
was,
country.
But the UK did this. So the oil in the North Sea, Norway took it and created their sovereign wealth.
Yes.
And the UK sold it straight away.
Well, the UK is becoming a developing country. It's true.
Yeah.
You can feel it. It's pretty crazy. Now, Norway may too, but the point is Norway would be doing way worse if they hadn't done
this. Of course.
But now you've got a chance for any country to copy the Norwegian model where you could expect similar returns, I think, over the next 30 years with a Bitcoin-focused strategy. So Bitcoin's at 85K today. Okay, so you went, I don't know. I think over the next 25 to 30 years, Bitcoin's going to do really well. And countries will be able to follow that strategy that made Norway a global superpower, basically, even with 4 million people.
With El Salvador, they've obviously had a back and forth with the IMF over the last few years.
Sure.
The IMF has kind of imposed that I think the IMF said they can no longer buy Bitcoin, but they have been buying Bitcoin. Who is this, which side of this is breaking? Is it El Salvador's kind of Bitcoin thesis or is it the IMF's?
Well, you can tell that the IMF does not like Bitcoin.
Yeah,
that's the most clear thing. Yes. There's a whole unit of people now, we know, at the IMF, because if you read that paper, it is crazy how many times Bitcoin's mentioned. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's clearly like a whole unit of people, a research team that's like, oh my God, we have to like stomp this out. Yeah. So I think the IMF's concerned. I think from El Salvador's point of view, I mean, remember, like they're a small country. They're not an economic powerhouse. I think the Bitcoin thing was helpful for Bukele, certainly still is. Now he's kind of shifted into the prison thing. That's his new thing he's selling. Instead of Bitcoin, it's he's selling, hey, we'll take your prisoners and we'll see. I mean, certainly something I've been critical of. But
me too, and people don't
like
crazy.
It. But hey, I don't think they're really that compatible. Like prison industrial complex and Bitcoin, aren't they supposed to be like different? But hey, you know, you do you. But the point is that I think that he just had to take the IMF money. I mean, it's too easy. And he's going to have to now comply with certain things that they want. And maybe he's made that decision. But it's like several, like I think it's a couple, like $1 billion or something. Mm-hmm. It's a huge amount of money for a small country. So maybe it's just too tempting. So maybe even the you know, this person who many thought was this hero of Bitcoin, well, they're having a hard time. So it's not going to be an easy transformation at all. My point is it happens slowly over time. And you're seeing, you know, glimmers of it now, for sure. You know, to the point of, I always look at Alan Farrington's essay, Wittgenstein's Money. Like, what would it seem like if we did have an open source, decentralized, neutral currency go from zero to reserve currency status? Well, it would look a lot like this, right? It would look like it would start really small and very niche and only on certain message boards and among tiny little communities. Then it would grow, and it would grow into real world applications like the Silk Road and other stuff, right? Then it would continue to grow and it would be volatile, but over time it would grow to retail investors in a particular niche market. Okay, that was the 2017 cycle. Okay, then it would, you know, maybe crash, but then it would go and grow again and it would grow into institutions and you would have mass media coverage. And then it might crash again, last cycle. But now we're seeing, okay, now we're getting nation state adoption. The reserve currency issuers literally stockpiling it. Like, now we're getting even bigger. So each cycle, it just is going to get deeper and deeper and more kind of ingrained and entrenched. Mm. And I just, that's what would happen. So it's like, we're watching it. It's pretty cool. And to my point, the reason I'm excited is, again, it continues to be so powerful as a freedom technology. I wouldn't be excited if it wasn't. So regardless of the nascent state adoption, I think people need to understand that the freedom aspect of it is like so powerful right now.
Yeah. It's funny on the freedom side, like, I've got criticized a lot for my takes on Bukele. Mm-hmm. I don't understand how Bitcoiners can be so pro-Bukele. He's done some great things. I'm sure he's made El Salvador a lot safer. But how they can get behind the idea of imprisoning people because they have tattoos who haven't been charged of a crime is mind-blowing to me.
It's just a trade-off they're making, and I disagree. I mean, you know, if you sacrifice liberty for security, you get neither. Mm-hmm. I guess they disagree. You know, it's very clear that Bukele has secured the country through deals with the gangs, so negotiating with the bad people. We'll see. We'll see how long that holds up. There's reason to believe that it's not as pretty as people think. I've talked to folks who are outside of the main areas, you know, of the city, and it gets pretty rough. There's violence and stuff outside of the Potemkin village that you get. If you land there and you go to Bitcoin Beach and some of these towns on the beach, and then you fly out, it's like you're kind of protected. In fact, of course, there's a lot of like, apparently, especially recently, there's a lot of like national police presence and security presence along that corridor. But there's other places in the country that apparently are not doing as well. So I don't even know if the description of the country as this like peaceful paradise is even true. But even if it was, I mean, they've turned it into a crazy police state where people just get picked up off the street by roving paramilitary type vans of unidentified people in black clothing. It's just like, that's insane.
Yeah, that's certainly not freedom.
Well, it's happening a little bit in the US too, on certain people. So, I mean, I read this. I mean, look, I try to remain optimistic and I try to like focus on what I'm focusing on. But some of it's a little distracting. Like, I read this post yesterday or the day before of two people from maybe not Australia, but from New Zealand. And they're like backpackers. And their port of entry was Hawaii. They were just coming here just to tourism. Mm-hmm. And they got, you know, into secondary, probably randomly, whatever. But like, as far as if we're talking about racial profiling and people targeting and being worried about like Palestinians or folks from the Middle East or from Muslim countries, okay, fine, that's one thing. No, these are like white people from New Zealand, right? Okay, so they get into secondary, and then they made the mistake, I guess, of saying they do some online freelance work. So then things got really intense, and they accused them of trying to work illegally here. And they were said, you know, the ICE people were like, you're inadmissible, you can't come here. So they're like, okay, we'll go back to New Zealand. They're like, okay, the flight's tomorrow. So they imprisoned them for a night in a jail. They strip searched them. It's freezing. They didn't have anything. They were like chained up and shit.
Wild.
Wild. Like, these are just tourists. Mm. So, and again, not like—
The reason that's wild is that could so easily be me.
Yeah, well, they didn't have like a freaking— My point is they didn't have a Palestinian flag pin on or whatever. These were just random people from New Zealand.
Yeah.
So it's like, and maybe there's more to the story, but this shit is happening. You can see it. People are starting to, so— But this is part of the plan of the current administration is to sort of shut down foreign investment, weaken the dollar, and bring back the manufacturing to this country. And in order to do that effectively over a short-ish period of time, you need to weaken the dollar. So like there's a guy, Fed guy, Joseph.
Yeah,
Joseph. So he's really good. So he's pointing out, like I think Luke is as well, everybody's like freaking out. Oh my God, look, Trump's crashing the economy. No. He's trying to do that.
Yeah.
Like his economic team wants to do that. They want a weaker dollar so that they can build stuff in America.
Yeah.
It's kind of like finally the structural adjustment thing coming home. It's like, well, how do you export more? You have to have a weaker currency and you have to cut government spending. That's what they would do to these poor countries. So they're kind of trying to do it here. And it's called austerity, and Americans are going to maybe feel it. We'll see.
Yeah.
They seem super intent about doing this. That's why, you know, he wants to get rid of Powell right now. As we speak, there's a fight between the president and the Fed chair, which is supposed to be independent, by the way.
And even if, like, so with that, Trump's obviously trying to find a way.
He's trying to weaken the dollar more. He's trying to get it to cut rates.
Of course.
He's trying to say there's no inflation.
And he's going to find a way to fire Powell. And that position is just going to become untenable. So either way, Powell is not going
to
be there.
He's continuing to centralize power around this idea.
Yeah.
But this is their thing. They want to like make stuff here. They don't want to rely on foreigners.
Yeah.
They want reduced foreign flow, generally speaking. And they want more indigenous stuff happening, like, you know, from our own country. And I may not agree with it, but like, I think people are making the mistake of thinking that it's chaos and they don't know what they're doing. No, they know exactly what they're doing and they're trying to achieve.
And they've told you as well.
Yeah, and they've told you repeatedly what they want to do. They want a weaker dollar. And, you know, we did this in the 80s, right? So Japan was rising power. It was the second largest economy in the world. People were terrified of Japan taking over and beating America, basically. So because we had the upper hand in terms of the military control in that area and our bases and everything, we had essentially helped rebuild them after the war. We were able to bring them to a table. You can look this up, the Plaza Accords, the Louvre meetings in the mid-80s. And we were able to get them to appreciate their currency against the dollar, right? And that meant they were no longer able to export so easily. And it basically crushed their economy and led to a massive stock bubble crash and the lost decades
of Japan. Yeah, they basically never recovered.
They never recovered. So that's what we did to them, and we're trying to do that to China right now. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get China to appreciate its currency against the dollar, or we're trying to weaken against them. It's not as easy, though, because we don't have the ability to just force them to do what we want. We don't have military bases all over China. They're a sovereign entity. So it's a little trickier. And China's basically saying, hey, maybe we can do this longer than you can.
Yep.
We're not a democracy. We can starve our people for a long time. So we're going to see. It's kind of like a game of chicken in a way. But this administration's made it really clear. Like, people should not be surprised or like chaotic or like, well, we don't know what's going on. No. Like, they are trying to reduce the dollar. They're trying to make it cheaper in wages and resources to build here. I don't know. I mean, like, short term, obviously the tariffs don't make sense in that respect because they make things more expensive here. But in their mind, that's the only way to do this. So it's interesting. I think a lot of people who voted for that party did not expect this, I would
for
say.
Sure.
A lot of people on Wall Street who just want their stocks to go up, they voted for Trump because they thought Kamala would be bad for the stock market. They're in for a very rude awakening, right? Yeah. It's like pretty funny.
The thing that does seem clear though is that Trump's probably not going to allow the stock market to languish for too
long.
I like,
think
he's going to try and run it hot into the midterm.
You know, to be fair, in 6 months or 10 months, we could be looking back at this being like,
It was a blip.
You know, we'll see.
Yeah.
But right now it looks pretty serious.
Yeah.
You know, structurally it's changing. Like, mm-hmm. like there may be nominally the stock market may recover, but you know, of course, you know what that means. Bitcoin will go crazy.
Yeah.
So we're seeing gold have its moment right now, right? Well, I mean, just wait until Bitcoin has its. Mm-hmm. Like it's pretty crazy to see this stuff happening. But, you know, hey, maybe Luke's right. Maybe we're about to rug China.
I hope so. That would be hilarious.
I mean, I think what will happen is gold's going up and then Bitcoin's going to have a huge leg up and then it'll be hard to dispute his claims, you know, basically.
For sure.
But it's a fascinating thesis.
We've only got 20 minutes left here, so I want to make sure we touch on the stablecoin piece.
Yes.
So again, like the Trump admin, it has a kind of clear objective, I think, with stablecoins too. I was in DC for the Policy Institute's thing maybe like a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Paolo was there, first time he'd been in the US.
Right.
He's obviously very close with Lutnick, so I'm sure he had some assurances of coming here and not getting black bagged. One of the things that really shocked me though, I've said this over and over again on the show, but it was really surprising to me, is just how quickly Tether is growing.
They're like 150 billion.
Onboarding 250,000 people a day.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Yeah.
So one of the big questions I would have around that is that slowing down Bitcoin adoption?
Mm. Yeah, I don't think so. I don't necessarily think someone who uses a dollar stablecoin would have used Bitcoin. I think they're slightly different, let's say, product market fits. If anything, maybe you could argue someone who's used a stablecoin on like a MetaMask wallet or even on an exchange is more likely to adopt Bitcoin than someone who hasn't. I don't know. I'm not sure about that claim. Yeah, I'm not sure. What I would say is that like stablecoins, without question, are entrenching the new system, expanding it, giving it a new way to grow in a risky time.
Like the new system or the old system? Because it also strengthens...
No, the old system.
Yeah, okay.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Sorry. The dollar fiat system is finding a new way to grow with stablecoins.
Mm-hmm.
So Paolo himself said the other day on Twitter, like, this is expanding dollar hegemony.
Yep.
Well, he's being very clear about it. Like, that's what they believe. So they're trying to pitch themselves as a dollar hegemonic tool to the U.S. government. And I think the U.S. government's going to like that. They're going to say, hey, this technology is expanding dollar hegemony, and it's a massive buyer of our debt mm-hmm. at a time when we need buyers of our debt, right? So we'll see. Maybe they iron out a deal. But I think people need to be, it's very important that you understand and differentiate Bitcoin from stablecoins. Bitcoin is building a new system. There was a wonderful framing of this the other day. I should read it to you.
Yeah, yeah.
Something that Jack Dorsey posted that I thought was just extremely on point with regard to stablecoins. So I'll read this. So basically, Jack Dorsey asked ChatGPT to talk about Bitcoin versus stablecoins. And the conclusion is that stablecoins are useful but dangerous if they dominate. They repackage fiat fragility in crypto form, offering short-term convenience but long-term control. Bitcoin is volatile, yes, but it's the only apolitical, incorruptible, borderless base layer monetary system humanity has ever had. If stablecoins dominate, financial freedom dies quietly. The dream of an open, decentralized world is smothered by convenience and compliance. If Bitcoin prevails, sovereignty becomes a default right, not a privilege. The monetary future becomes a shared protocol, not a leveraged empire.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I'm like, no, like AI is getting to the point where it can really enhance your viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's necessarily that helpful if you have mediocre content to put into it. It's not going to like turn you into an amazing content creator. But if you know what you're doing, it's an incredible tool right now. We have our own program to help activists and nonprofits really supercharge by using AI. I'm really excited about that. But on the stablecoin part, I think it's true. Like, this is pretty black and white here. Like, stablecoins again are an extension of the current system of control of all the currency caste system stuff of dollar hegemony. And Bitcoin is a completely different paradigm that promises an open, borderless, apolitical world where you can't be discriminated against. I mean, we'll see how far we get on that promise, but that's the promise. So I think it's super important that we just sort of discriminate these two things.
Mm.
This is why the Human Rights Foundation has Bitcoin education and Bitcoin courses. We don't teach stable coins.
Yeah.
Now we empathize and we will show you how to convert your Bitcoin into it without giving up all this personal information to some giant corporation if you need to, and we're even interested in ways to achieve a dollar price kind of hedge using Bitcoin natively.
Is that like stable channels online?
Yeah, that's that sort of thing. I mean, we're interested in it. I mean, it just seems so difficult for it to ever compete with the traditional model. But even those are still, again, supporting the system in some way.
Yeah.
So I think, like, at the end of the day, it's important to just, you know, the real goal is Bitcoin is P2P money globally. The real goal is essentially, you know, what Ross Ulbricht built, but globally, like, that we can all commerce with each other regardless of who we are, and that we can in a non-discriminating way have access to a global marketplace to trade, interact, etc. So that's what, you know, the Bitcoin ecosystem really needs to be about, I think, is this peer-to-peer ecosystem of growth and people buying and selling things with Bitcoin.
For sure.
Yeah, so that's what I'm very committed to that.
So with Tether now, obviously Lutnick's in the Trump administration.
Sure.
Cantor Fitzgerald hold all of Tether's reserves.
Yeah.
Tether obviously went through a lawsuit again in New York. Do you think they are at least somewhat in the pocket of the US? And do you think there's a real threat that they kind of become the de facto CBDC?
Yeah, I don't really understand the stablecoin CBDC thing. Like, CBDCs are issued directly by government.
Okay, so like
that's a very important part of a CBDC.
PBDC maybe, private bank digital currency.
Well, then how is that different from a Visa card?
Well, I guess if they're in the pocket of the US government, the US government dictates what they can do.
That's the case for Visa today.
True.
I like the reason why stablecoins are different is they don't require ID. That is why they're valuable and popular. And that's what makes them a humanitarian tool. And that's what forces us to empathize with the users of them. If you're in Lebanon or Turkey or Nigeria or Argentina and you're using Tether, I totally get you. I understand. I hope you're aware that what you're doing micro, maybe that you need for your family right now, it's going to contribute to more pain in the future, basically is my point. Now, a lot of people don't have the privilege of thinking long-term, so I get it. It's a complicated topic. But at the end of the day, the reason why they're useful is they don't require KYC. The moment they get quote-unquote CBDC, right, it would require full biometric identification to use. And they would be freaking useless. It would mean that they would no longer be able to be used by the refugee in Lebanon or the, you know, black market business in Nigeria or the person trying to get away from the tax regime in Argentina. These would not work anymore. It would require your name and all this other information, and like the US government would be aware of you and be able to cut you off and tax you and all these things. So I don't agree at all with the like stable coins are going to be the new CBDC thing. It makes no sense. If they do, then they go to zero. They don't go to zero, but they lose massive amount of their value if they become more like traditional fiat money, meaning more KYC. But in no way, I mean, they don't resemble CBDCs at all. Like CBDCs are issued directly by the government, which Tether is not, even Circle with all of its ties to the U.S. government apparatus is not, and B, their whole premise is full tie to your ID stack. So I just don't see any resemblance at all between the two. Ultimately, the game for the U.S. government is going to be how long do we promote this technology that we can't really control, but it benefits us. So we'll see. But right now, it seems like Paolo's coming back. Like, they're doing meetings. Like, I wouldn't be shocked to see this thing grow to $300 billion or even $1 trillion in the next few years.
Yeah.
You got to know that the moment they impose shotgun KYC on the system, it just becomes a whole lot less useful for, like, a lot of people. And especially people in developing countries or activists or whatever, it would just become immediately not useful.
So back to your timeline, if we go through a period where it's like Bitcoin plus fiat, that's where stablecoins fit. And then eventually we're going to be...
Yeah, eventually the stablecoin is going to be like a BTC, you know, like eCash type credit, right, of Bitcoin. And that's a great question for the future, right? In 100 years, will everybody be able to access Bitcoin as freedom money? Or is it only going to be affordable to some people? And that's the long-term question.
100%.
That's what we're going to be looking at and focusing on for sure and thinking deeply about that because that's important.
I mean, number we need to pump.
Yeah. And like, look, even if it's only available for a few hundred million people, it's way better than today. We're like a tiny fraction of that can actually have real money or whatever. You know, again, the US is only 4% of the world's population. So,
this is what I was talking to Adele about. There was basically, that was the whole premise of the conversation, is like, what percentage of the world will be able to use Bitcoin as freedom?
Oh,
money?
Interesting.
Yeah. And he kind of threw out 5% as a number. He said, maybe that'll be high. But even though that seems very low, it's a lot of people.
It's a hell of a lot of people. Yeah. I mean, again, I think there's a world where it's way more than that. It depends.
So.
If stuff like ARC works, it's really exciting. It doesn't even require a major change to Bitcoin. It could just, you know, maybe. But we'll see. I also think that, like, because of, to loop it back to the beginning of our conversation today, I think Bitcoin thrives partly because it's programmable. Absolutely. That's one of its superpowers, is it can adapt and evolve, right? And it's going to adapt and evolve in some way to overcome quantum threat, right? Mm-hmm. We don't know exactly how. We'll see. But I think that is going to open the door a little bit more for some of these other changes. I think that that's going to be something that is helpful. Like there's some real serious things people want to do right now with Bitcoin that would allow it to be more usable as money for billions of people, whether it be with CTV or any other tweaks people are presenting. You know, I don't have a personal stance on any of them at the moment. You know, we did some research into cross input signature aggregation, which is really interesting. That does a different thing. But I mean, there's a bunch of tweaks people are proposing. But I do think the inevitability of having to change Bitcoin potentially, or at least having to roll out a new set of addresses, which would be a soft fork, right, for quantum, I think does probably help lead the way for some of these other changes.
Yeah.
Because maybe they get packaged together. So we'll see. The exciting part is Bitcoin can change. Gold cannot change. Eventually, we're going to find that asteroid in the outer space that has all this gold, and gold's monetary premium is basically just going to go to zero, right? Mm-hmm. If we're like a spacefaring civilization, there's no, gold does not have the same value as it has today because there's so much gold in outer space, right? Bitcoin can evolve where gold cannot, right? And that makes it, you know, someone was saying the other day, it was a great take. Maybe we close with this, but they were saying, you know, man created Bitcoin and can destroy it. Man didn't create and cannot destroy gold. End of story. There's some gold bug said this. And I'm kind of like, my response was, man can definitely destroy the monetary premium of gold and is going to do so.
Yeah.
You watch. You know?
All we have to do is find it.
Yeah. I mean, well, forget that. I mean, even if we don't find the asteroid of gold, Bitcoin is going to demonetize gold over the next several decades.
Yeah.
It's just without question. So, it's funny because this person's wanting to think of it like that. Like, oh, it's like a natural thing. We absolutely can destroy the monetary premium of gold. I mean, destroy is probably the wrong word. Obsolete is probably the word.
Yes.
We will obsolete gold as money, as savings technology. It'll still be used for, you know, industrial uses, religious uses, cultural uses. But like no one would seriously save in it for like 20 years as opposed to Bitcoin. I don't think. So I guess we'll see.
Yeah.
But it'll be interesting to see how things shake out. But anyway, yeah, more bullish than ever on Bitcoin as freedom money, despite all of the, you know, adoption from big bad actors. And I guess I would say partly because of the adoption from all these actors that we don't like. I think that's partly how you have to see Bitcoin's success. You're measuring it by how many people that you don't like are using it. And for a lot of the cypherpunks, a disconcertingly large number of people that they don't like are now using Bitcoin. But I think that was always going to happen.
Inevitable.
It's beautiful, yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for this, Alex. That's been great.
Awesome. Great to do it in person.
Yes. Where do you want to send anyone? Tell everyone about HRF.
Yeah, I think for now, we have the Oslo Freedom Forum coming up soon.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to have a killer freedom tech and Bitcoin program. It's in Norway, so you have to go there. But tickets are available. You have to apply to attend. But I would encourage you to do that if you're interested in meeting some awesome, really high signal Bitcoiners. It is unfortunately not by our choice. It's during the Bitcoin Vegas conference. So this is more of an appeal to folks probably in, you know, Africa, Asia, Europe, who may not be going to Vegas, but that's happening. Our newsletter really is what I would recommend people check out. It's going to have all the information on our events, on our webinars, on everything we do comes out every Thursday morning, the Financial Freedom Report. You can sign up at financialfreedomreport.org. It's a killer product. I spend a lot of time with it every week, and I'm very proud of what the team puts out there. So check that out. We're more than, I believe, 75 weeks in.
Amazing.
We haven't missed a week.
It's a great newsletter.
Thank you, Danny. Appreciate you. So thanks again for having me on.
No, I appreciate you. And it's one of the only newsletters that I actually read every single week because I get so many of them, but it is very good. So go and subscribe. Thank you, Alex. It's been great.
All right, dude. Thank you.